Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Wherever you are in the world, I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell Tovey, I am feeling like a self-disruptor.
Oh, really?
Yes, and I think being a self-disruptor is a really good thing because it is, actually, there's a quote, it's an enviable space of doing what you love and being true to yourself. And it's the description, I think, fits our guest today perfectly because our guest today has a kind of very clear mind. I mean, that's the kind of best way to describe her.
Yeah, clarity, clarity, clarity.
Clarity, clarity, clarity. And she has a real joy for life and a joy for business. And in some ways, on paper, she could seem quite terrifying because she's just like a groundbreaking kind of earth-shattering...
Powerhouse. Yeah.
Powerhouse, genius business person. And if you look at all the numbers, you know, that she's been involved with in the art world, it's just extraordinary, like hundreds of millions. I mean, it's just insane. But at the same time, I am interested to find out what makes this guest tick, you know, and the kind of passions and the love of art that has led her to this extraordinary, groundbreaking career. So we would like to welcome, and actually I must just quickly say, every time I think of this guest, I always think of the song by Amy Winehouse that goes, Amy, 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 like that. And I love that song. So just remembering Amy Winehouse briefly. But I would like to welcome to Talk Art, Amy Capalazzo. Hi, Amy.
Hi there. How are you guys?
We're
Russell,
doing
Robert,
completely.
Thank you for having me. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Whereabouts are you in the world?
I am in New York City in 10021 at my office at Sotheby's.
Amazing. Well, before we start, I just want to say that we love your voice. As we said in the intro, the clarity of your voice, but you also always seem to be smiling. Always.
That's
a wonderful thing.
I'm such a smiley. I was talking to my niece yesterday and we were describing a situation and she and I are very similar characterologically and she was saying that some of her friends say she has toxic positivity. She's always like upbeat and positive. And I was like, yeah, it's like a Capalazzo thing. Like we're super, you know, we have a lot of toxic positivity, like COVID. Okay, let's learn how to make pasta, you know, that sort of thing. So.
Is Capalazzo, that's an Italian name, right?
Yes, sono italiana. I'm Italian for sure.
Do you speak Italian as well?
I do actually from my parents.
Amazing, because I've watched a lot of interviews and, you know, we're quite starstruck right now. I feel quite starstruck around you, Amy. You have this like, quality,
stop.
This really shiny quality. But looking at your interviews, it feels like you, when it comes to business, you really appreciate people who speak more than one language.
In fact, I've been said that on the record. Yeah, I think it's very, I think your brain just has a whole different set of networks and neural pathways when you speak a second language. And I'm sure that's quite literally true, in fact. But it also means you might be more nimble or quick on your feet in a tense or tight moment. So it also means maybe you can change directions in your thinking faster, or quicker, or something like that.
Right. And when it comes to business, having that second language has helped you and you've seen it help other people?
I guess so. Yes, I think, yes, I would say so. I think it's, I think it helps me. I think having a second language helps me think about things a little bit differently. Yes. What does that mean? Well, like Italian is, I speak Italian, I would say well, and, you know, Spanish, like vaguely conversationally in a very basic sense. So and Spanish and Italian are very related, as you know. But I think that Italian is really good for emotion, as cliches indicate, right? The Italian language lends itself well to description, to sort of flowery language. You use a lot of that in selling art. So sometimes I actually think of something in Italian and I put it in English and spit it out in English or something like that. So there's Italian's good for lots of things. Like, I would say it's a bit in the national character to be slightly hypochondriacal. So Italian has tremendous amount of adjectives for how specifically you feel ill in whatever capacity. Like, it was good for that too.
So you said that you're at Sotheby's, where you are the chairman of Fine Art Division, and you've been there since 2016?
Yes.
And have you been going into Sotheby's daily during all of lockdown? Is it something that you've been allowed to do or able to get into the office?
Well, no, there was certainly a period in the beginning that was very seriously a lockdown, and nobody was coming in the building except for just a few essential members of security, etc. I would say that since we did our first Studio Live sale in June, I've been coming in with some regularity every week, a couple days, or sometimes a little more. Sometimes if it's a quiet week or I don't have much going on that requires my physical presence, I suppose because we were all under a certain limited lockdown, I would stay, work from home or something like that. But I'm in pretty frequently now. It's starting to feel, I don't know how it is over in London this moment, but it's starting to feel a little bit more hopeful in New York. And the vaccine distribution is starting to feel like it's taking effect. And I think, I just feel that spirit of New Yorkers coming alive again, really. I mean, not that it ever died. It was even in dour moments, there were such great moments of New Yorkismo, people doing things. But like last night I went with my son to see the David Hammons body print show that's at the Drawing Center in Soho. Yep. So we went down there and then we walked a little bit through Soho and then we were walking to go have dinner sort of in NoHo area, like West Village. And we saw all these people dressed like, the thing about COVID is no one got dressed actually. Like no one really dressed up in any sort of way, right? But I saw this person, my son and I were staring. It was magnificent. We saw a person dressed as like a pylon, like an electric neon colored yellow green pylon with like police tape around them and wearing like yellow green. And I thought then someone else was dressed just like, it was all cosplay. Like people were in their cosplay moment. But I thought to myself, the butterflies are back.
Oh,
like everybody, like all the wonderful radiance of New York, all the, supernatural excellence of color and light are coming back and we're going to have butterflies again. So just to see people all dressed up like that made me feel so great.
You know, something that really struck me about you when I've met you in the past at art fairs and places like that is your strong connection to the people that you advise and that you work with. And I know before you were at Sotheby's, before they bought your company art agency, you were advising and working very closely, and I guess you still do now, with a number of leading collectors. But how does that all work for you? Is that the most important part of your job, would you say, that kind of human relationship, like with a collector? Is that the bit you enjoy the most?
Well, I like people. I like objects and I like people, and it's important to like them a lot, both of them. But some days I like objects more than people. And so, I can be like 60% loving objects today, 40% people. And then some days I suppose it's the reverse. Like I'm 60% adoring humans and 40%. Yes, the objects are wonderful, but objects can give you great solace and great, great meditation and rumination and thinking. And there's sort of an unassailable quality to looking at a great object. Like there's just, it's not deniable.
Where did that love of great objects come from? Because I'm a collector and, to pop psychoanalyze, I'm always really fascinated of people's assumptions of what the collecting bug is. But where did your love of objects come from?
I've tried to dissect this many times and tried to sort of come to my self-actualized place of understanding that. I'm not sure I can, but I can say that, look, I think to be a collector, you have to believe in the material world. So you have to be a little bit of a hardcore materialist. Now, I'm not really interested in like certain kinds of material things. Like I have a passing interest in clothing and fashion and probably like, I'm not really interested in cars or things like that, but I really love things that are made. Like I really love art objects. I like certain design objects too, like I like furniture and things, but I really love mysterious things that are made. So I think it's really, so I guess you would say de facto, if I'm a hardcore lover of objects, I must not be a high spiritualist, right? Because spirituality and materialism would be on a certain continuum opposite one another, perhaps. But I am an earthly creature, though I do like culture and tradition and ritual. I'm not a terribly, you know, I'm not like that. I'm not that sort of distracted by the other dimension of spiritual. I do meditate and I do have like moments of being alone, but I'm sort of an earthly soul, I suppose. So don't mean to like, you know, rank myself a heathen here or any kind of, you know, like lowly amoeba of spirituality. But I believe this is the best time to ever have lived. And there's wonderful things being made and done in the world right now. And I believe we're lucky to be here right now. And, you know, this is it. This is what you get. This is life. Yeah. So
yeah. So what led you to art? Because I heard that you studied at an architecture school originally and kind of like urban design. And then you moved to the Pratt Institute and did art. So what was it that sort of led you from architecture towards art?
So it's actually the reverse. I studied art history at NYU as an undergraduate, and then I studied architecture design. So, okay. So that's okay. I mean, I guess, you know, as a young person, I knew that I wanted to study. I loved my art history program, and I knew that I wanted to study something in the visual field. I guess for a moment, I thought I might be a maker of art, you know, a designer.
Really?
Yeah, well, if you study architecture, you have some momentary, at least brief
modern
aspiration
making.
Of thinking you're going to make something. But I learned really quickly in a graduate program of architecture, urban design, and city planning that I was not that talented a designer. Mm. And it's what they call in America a first professional master. So it was a 3.5-year course for a second degree. And I learned maybe like in the second or third week that I was going to be only an average designer, a great presenter of ideas.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, like not, I was probably just, you know, my three-dimensional drawing skills were only average at best.
And did I you had have a crisis about that? Was there a crisis?
You know what? I'm very fixated on completion. I always do what I say I'm going to do. And I was like, I have to finish this degree. I'm going to like grind through it. So I did. And I think there's parts of the designer architecture world I would have been well suited for, but it certainly wasn't the actual maker at the drafting table side of it.
Did you grow up with art then, or did you grow up visiting museums and, you know, design?
I grew up in my hometown, Buffalo, New York, has a superb art museum called the Albright Knox, which
love
I use
it.
Any moment I can to proselytize about its greatness. And in fact, I'm headed there tomorrow. And it's a superb museum, and it gave me a whole kind of belief system of possibility and the future. Evangelically, like nothing else could, going to the Albright Knox as a child.
So, and do you take yourself off there as a teenager as well? Is it a sort of thing you would just enjoy as part of like social life?
Yeah, I would say that. They used to have, you know, back then museums weren't quite as inviting to the, you know, they were small little clubs of whoever they cut it, but the Albright Knox had, you know, I would go with my friends definitely. They also had like a really incredible jazz program, like a musical program that they would do. And that would, you know, you'd invite it in the museum and then you'd go out to one of the sort of beautiful outdoor terrace courtyards and have jazz there. And Buffalo, New York has a fabulous music tradition as well with jazz, etc. And if you know the band Spyro Gyra, I used to go hear Spyro Gyra play. They're from Buffalo, New York. And so I, you know, there was some combination of visual arts and music that were fused or synergistically connected in terms of my passionate cultural development. So, yes.
And do you have any memories of the artist that first struck you at that kind of time?
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess I have to say something different than Giacomo Balla, because the dynamism of the dog on a leash, which is a very famous painting. I talk about that and people send me pictures of it all the time on the internet because I talk about it in that movie. But, there's so many things that I loved growing up in that museum. Like the Albright Knox owns the very famous Gauguin painting, Yellow Christ, mm-hmm. Very famous painting, like illustrated, you know, if you Google Gauguin, it's probably the first thing that comes up. And there's so many great objects like Rauschenberg's Ace and, you know, just incredible Jackson Pollock, de Kooning, Jasper Johns.
I saw a Liechtenstein, like the big cutout Liechtenstein.
Yeah, Redhead. But I even think of some of the more obscure things that are in that museum because I know the collection quite well. So there's a lot of, you know, churches and so what we call what we call at the auction house American paintings, which would be sort of 1880 to 1940 or something like that. American, when the crown of the art world was back in Europe and the provincial Americans were doing their thing. But I like a lot of work from that period as well.
Would that be so Grant Wood, people like that?
Yeah, sure, Grant Wood and, you know, the wonderful Georgia O'Keeffe and just terrific things like that. Georgia O'Keeffe, she's not even a painter you can place in a particular era. Like, she's timeless. She is golden. She is stardust. She is everything.
She's almost like nature or something. She's essential.
Totally. And she is even alive with us today, I believe.
Yes.
Is she?
Love that. No, Russ, but like...
I was like, what? Hang on a minute.
It's like when I met Nicole Scherzinger from Pussycat Dolls and she said, Prince, my friend Prince is no longer with us, but he is with us. That's the same kind of thing. Like our friend Georgia O'Keeffe.
Oh, Georgia O'Keeffe is so... she's animated in me every day, so alive and well to me.
So when you decided that you weren't going to be a maker, how did you then get into like art advising? How did that route happen?
Well, I guess when you realize you're not good at making art, then you figure out how to make art happen.
Right.
So I realized I was better at making art happen than making art.
Do you think like a collector? Do you think of when you see art, I would like that in my collection? Is that the sort of journey in?
I mean, I must say I do a bit, yeah.
Do you collect now and have you consistently collected?
Well, I collect now, of course, but I think on a more modest level than most everybody I work with, for sure. But I collect and I think that there's, there's so much about what I do that is calculating or thought, you know, really thought out, like, how am I going to approach this piece of business or how am I going to structure this deal or how am I going to get these 10 things done in a short span of time today, something like that. But when I'm thinking of art, I have all of the kind of, obviously, the intellectual and marketplace underpinning to help me make a good decision, I suppose. But I really get to act completely on like physical force. Like it's like my heart or my head or my gut is telling me I have to do this.
Mm. What do you collect? Who do you collect? And are you ever envious of your kind of collectors that you work with, of their collections? Are you like, I really want this, but I think you should get
it? I'm only envious. I only get upset if I don't feel like they love it or enjoy it.
Right.
If they love it, it's okay. It's just, as long as that object that is so spectacular is being loved in the world, I'm okay with it.
And who do you collect?
Well, I collect a lot of things. I do have a few Georgia O'Keeffes.
Oh, you do?
Small ones, very petite ones.
Amazing.
They're like spiritual objects of devotion in my life. Those were sort of recent purchases. I felt like I needed, you know, since I was getting old and stuff, and I realized I'm probably far more than half dead. It was time to find
time to get Georgia O'Keeffe.
It was time to like have what I thought I needed to, you know,
continue
live out the rest of my life wholly.
Can we just note that you're drinking from a Studio Museum Harlem mug at the minute? Black and Beautiful.
Black is beautiful, babe. There you go. This is my beautiful. I love this mug. I got it. Remember when I bought it at the studio shop, I was talking to Thelma and I said, I'm going to get these. And in fact, I bought like 5 of them. I bought them for everyone in my office. And it's a perfect mug.
It looks it.
How do you balance the kind of combination of like having to place work so that they financially are an investment for a collector, say, that you work for, but also to create collections that have personality? Because when we met at Frieze years ago, I was really struck by you brought a collector to us who had fallen in love with a younger artist who I won't mention, but... And I was really struck that they were so passionately involved in these works, which were only like 2,000 euros or something, you know.
Right.
And you really supported that purchase because you could see how much the collector cared about those works. So is it important for the collector to sort of, you know, create this collection that has a personality that reflects them as much as the interest in financial sort of security, I guess?
Well, I would say everything all at once all the time, right? So if you're going to do something, do it with love, like do it with love and passion. At the same time, you know, if you're going to spend a sum of money that would have a net effect if it didn't work out, well, let's make a good decision rather than a bad one. So, right. You know, there are people in the world that I've worked with who love more than they're easy, free lovers. You know, they give a lot, like they love 100 things. Okay, well, of the 100 things, we're going to pick 10 or something like this, right? Then there are people I've worked with who, like, of 100 things, they love maybe approximately half of one. You know, they're very so it's about like accessing the part of the person that feels satisfied in the experience and finds a kind of love. And that also means a sort of security and knowing they made a good decision. So arguably that's a form of security, can be a form of love, I suppose.
Yeah. And what are your favorite type of collectors?
What are my favorite type of collectors? I don't really know if I have a favorite type. I mean, sometimes I like them. I've met collectors who are super erudite and intellectual and know every single thing about every object they have. And then I met people who just haphazardly bought things they loved and didn't have any prescription of how it was all going to come together. And I could love them the same. So I'm sort of Jungian on that front. Not Freudian, Jungian. Like it's sort of, I'm open to the collective universe. All of them can be interesting or not.
Yeah. 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 So when COVID kicked in and everything sort of ground to a halt, what were the fears for the art world? And I know that it ended up reacting in a way that no one really expected because it kind of went out on crack suddenly, I felt. But what was it like at the beginning trying to navigate that?
Well, I mean, there were two challenges. One was just the larger marketplace as a whole, like was the whole big world going to collapse? Mm. And then B, if we were going to keep the art market alive, what would be the logistics we needed to engage in order to do that, right? Because for centuries, the concept of coming in and seeing a work of art has been the litmus test as to whether or not you'll buy it, correct? So if barring that, how could we keep the market transacting, even though the typical mechanics of due diligence and purchase couldn't be employed? So, you know, thankfully we were on the cusp of the digital revolution over here at Sotheby's and had done a lot of investment in the infrastructure here. And, you know, all that played to our strengths and advantages as we pivoted and went into that. So I was happy about that.
Yeah. So you had going into it online, because the online sales and online shows and everything really, luckily, you know, if this was like 10 years ago, we would have definitely all fallen apart. I mean, we would have fallen apart socially as humans because we wouldn't have had Zooms, we wouldn't have had the FaceTimes.
Right. No, we would have been really, really, you're absolutely right. Entirely right.
Yeah. So what position is the art world in now then? Now it feels like it's more hopeful and we are going into a post-COVID or vaccinated world.
Yeah, I think things are starting to open up a little bit. I mean, look, not everybody will have survived equally as well. There's definitely people who have suffered and are not going to come out of this the same either financially or mentally. Mm-hmm. So I'm mostly concerned about the mental health of people because I think that's the most important thing. That's what I think of. I've been, since the beginning of COVID, I was like, look, better sick than crazy, like really important to like not make yourself anxious crazy and try to keep your grounding and your bearing and keep a sense of humor about life. And so, I think we'll see an art world with a slightly different texture. I think we'll see a breakdown of the traditional calendar, the marriage to the calendar of like, well, this is the week of Art Basel here, and this is the week of Art Basel there, and this is the week of the auctions, and, you know, this is when the Turner Prize gets. I mean, I think everything's just going to be up for grabs, really. And we don't really need that sort of temporal schedule, right? We can do something great or interesting when we've gathered the resources to do it rather than have to punt it out on a particular week because we're depending on physical convening.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about when you get into a very powerful position, you know, after many years of your career and as you are right now in a very senior position. I read that you had supported artists like Forrest Bess's kind of market and the way that you'd help rediscover and highlight artists that maybe had been forgotten or left out of history. How important is that idea of like social change within an organization like Sotheby's? Because I also heard people like Google currently are doing things like on Google Maps, they're going to be highlighting kind of black-run businesses or, you know, LGBT initiatives and businesses and charities, like actually on Google Maps to kind of make it easier to identify how you can support different organizations and people. I was really impressed to hear that about you and Forrest Bess and so on.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think, you know, part of being in this, I mean, part of having this position is to, you know, one of the privileges is to bring a little justice to the marketplace of those who deserve their due and didn't get it. And I think, I don't think that's unique to me or to this time. I think, you know, a lot of people in my position over the years have probably had some unsung hero they wanted to champion, and that was the case. And I think in this moment, we've certainly seen a worthy resurgence of certain African-American artists, women, other artists of color, where they've, you know, particularly those, not those that are 26 years old, fresh out of school, you know, but those who have 30, 40 years of work behind them and have worked for years and years without that kind of recognition. So I think, you know, you, it's very interesting and gratifying and important to have those moments where you're helping a historical correction happen. Yes. So is it gratifying to sell a $50 million Rothko? Sure. But not, you know, I know that feeling well. So, but it feels good when you've like shined a little light on a particular artist's career.
Yeah.
You know, Forrest Bess or Barclay Hendrix or, you know, Norman Lewis or Grace Hardigan or anybody who was sort of overlooked by art history and probably deserved a little more light than they got in their day.
How do you find artists? Like, as like the art market now obviously sets the trends, but when you was advising, where was the best route you'd find like really exciting emerging artists, for example?
Well, you know, there is always the galleries. There are also, now I think there's also Instagram, which plays a big role in people just putting things up there. And sometimes it's Instagram in service to a gallery show that I might not get to see because it's in another part of the world or something. So I think we're living in the most visually interesting and arguably saturated time. So there's so much to see. It's really the sorting exercise that's really critical. So, you know, you have to have different data points that you source on. And what I worry for really is just the works of art that are not quite as mediagenic as the others. You know, think of all the artists that would never have had a career if they were coming of age now. Like Robert Ryman would not have been really meaningful if he was depending on Instagram for his following.
But they are in the square automatically.
they're in the square, but they don't. But you know, they don't. Appearing as postage stamps on an iPhone probably doesn't do them justice at all. You see none of the texture, none of the surface. So I can think of many artists where, well, they look good in that format and others that just simply do not. So,
yeah.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
So when it comes to auctions, do you love the theatricality of the auctions? Because I've been to a few auctions and I get like palpitations. And when I've bid on things and when I've lost, when that gavel goes down, it's like they're telling me off for not being rich enough. And I feel like, do you love the auctions? Because watching the price of everything and you're on the phone, it feels like you're really in like a really nice zone for you. That's like a sweet spot.
I mean, it's very comfortable and familiar to me, I would say. Do I love the auctions? I like everything that leads up to the auction more than I like the auction.
Right.
But I'm okay in the auction. Like, I'd never get nervous. I'm not ever nervous at the auction.
Yeah, you didn't seem it.
I'm pretty steady in that moment. And I sort of, the part, in a way, the auction is sort of formula, right? There's like a script. It's going to go a certain way. I'm going to take this bid, this bid, this bid. I'll look at my bid sheet. I'll be like, 95% chance I have the winning bid on this one because I know this person. I know their spirit. I know where their head is right now. So I was like, you know, this person's got one bid at the low and we're done. You know, like I sort of know what's going to happen before it happens.
Is there competition between all you guys up there on the phones?
Well, we are usually bidding against each other with our specific clients, so it has that feeling. But I would say the auction is like, it's fun. It's energizing. It's a bit formulaic, but yeah, yes, I like the auction. I like even online bidding myself because I like the gaming aspect.
It's like eBay.
I've never been like an online gamer or like interested in, you know, like my son plays like FIFA all the time. I love to watch it, but I love the feeling of like, what do you mean I'm being outbid? Like there's a certain mechanic of the gaming club. Like, I'm like, hit it real quick, and like I kind of like that too. So
do you ever feel bad for collectors, because there was that one story of that woman who wanted the Enjadeka Akineli Crosby work and then she got outbid, and I felt really sad for her.
I know, do
these collectors ever feel like call you up after and a bit like, oh, I'm really sad, or I wish I'd got more, or do you feel guilty that
a lot of times it's my job to like push them and prepare them to go much high, like, you know, to prepare them to run the mile. And I often have a conversation with them. Look, the next morning you wake up and you don't have it. How do you feel? I'll feel awful. Okay, well then just, you know, go to the end, because if in many cases it's not the money that, you know, the extra bit of money, whatever, it's like in many cases that's not even a factor for the clients. It's more just like allowing themselves to have it.
Yeah, there was a really beautiful thing you said where you feel there's a responsibility for that moment because this is a memory for them. This is probably one of the biggest, most important things that sort of happened to them in their adult life. And you're there as the conduit to that experience. So you feel the responsibility that it all goes to plan.
Yeah, and I have to take them to the other side, right? So it's a bit like a midwife. I've got to get them over the
birth.
We're giving birth to something here, right? Exactly.
What was it like, the experience of that documentary, The Price of Everything? It was an HBO documentary, and so many people around the world saw it. And I've read the recent interviews with you where people now say that you're the most recognisable person in the auction business, you know, partly because of the amazing work that you've done over the years at Christie's and now Sotheby's, but also because of that, the result of that film. Did you notice an effect? Like, are you more recognised than previously?
I mean, a little bit. I suppose, yeah. I mean, let's just say that I could only play myself in film, so that I have a very short film career here. Like, I'm not really, you know. But, right after it came out, people would sort of come up to me in an airport or say, are you that person in The Price of It? You know, like, that would happen, but I don't really care. I mean, I'm not, like, I wasn't. And then I had some of my friends, mostly artists, who were like, you were terrible in that. That was awful. And I was like, okay, whatever. So it's just my day job. I don't really, it might even be a 20% dramatization of my day job, but it's just like what I do all day. It's not really, I'm not even sure it's that interesting actually, but I guess it is.
It is. It's fascinating.
But I have no feeling about, I mean, I feel fine about it. Like when I watched it, I was like, okay, it's about what it is.
It felt accurate to you.
Yeah. I mean, it's of course made to be cinematic, so it has like certain cuts and jump cuts that are a bit
music.
Dramatic for, but I mean, it's essentially what it is. Yeah.
I think the response to it is so strong though, only because it goes into people's homes. And I think the way that people are relating now to television is way more personal than it was even 5 years ago. So I think maybe that's the way that, you know, when we first came on this chat, we were both a bit starstruck only because we don't know you. Do you know what I mean? And I think it is a very personal experience that in some ways, I guess.
I mean, I feel like, I think certain people feel they know me from that film.
Right.
And they don't.
I'm like, you don't know me. No, I don't know. Maybe you know me, you know, like, I don't know. You certainly know a part of me. I mean, this sort of, you know, I'm not that.
Do you ever get starstruck? Talking about us being starstruck. Is there any artist that you've ever met or you would meet and just be like buckle?
I'm trying to think of like the last time I actually got a little, well, I did one time. Yeah. Years ago, I was at a party in Los Angeles. Actually, I remember exactly when it was. It was just as I was leaving Christie's. So it would have been December 2013.
And you've been there for 13 years at Christie's.
Yes, because when the announcement came out, I was leaving. I wanted to not be in New York. So I went to Los Angeles and I was, you know, with some friends. And I was at, it was around a little before Christmas time. And I went to a Christmas party at Annie Philbin's house. It was a very, very dear friend of mine, director of the Hammer Museum. Mm-hmm. So I was at Annie and Cynthia's sitting by the pool, very Los Angeles kind of evening, right? We're in like Sunset Plaza, that part of town. And we're by this pool and you could see all of L.A. glimmering up before you. And in walks Joni Mitchell.
Wow.
I know, right? I was like, I don't even know what to say. Like, I have to, like, someone has to help me close my jaw here. I'm so starstruck because she is a real serious person in my life. Like a very, like Georgia O'Keeffe, like she's that level original gangster of my life. Like she's for real. I know every word to every song she's ever written. I know everything about Joni Mitchell. So she came in and I was like, I was like stupid. Like I was like stuttering, you know, I didn't know what to say. And I think Annie came over, Annie, you have to talk to Joni, you know, you're really gonna something like this. And, well, I mean, you know, it was just incredible. But then I realized, then she started to talk about how she was smoking and like, she always smokes, you know, if you follow her films, that's one of the, or you follow, like smoking is like a big accessory of hers. And she said, I hate that de Kooning shit. What kind of painting is that? You know, she was really like outspoken. And I was like, okay. You know, she was like, I'm a much better painter than he is. And I was sort of like, girl, go. Like, you know, that's false. But I also thought there was something on the edge of that that was a little bit like, whoa, that's a little bit like off-piste of what I was expecting.
Yeah.
So I was like, let me not be from the art world and just talk about her music and her songs so I can be more on point with like what I really get from Joni.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's
amazing.
I know people know that I love her so much that my friend John Kelly, do you know him? He's a performance artist.
Yes.
In New York here.
He's great.
He does he's amazing. John Kelly, he's a superb artist. He does a performance that's about Joni Mitchell, like where he does like a drag performance of Joni, but it's not drag. It's homage. It's not drag. Mm-hmm. But he does dress like Joni. So the untrained eye would see it as drag, but it's not, it's really homage. And he gave me a matchbook that was signed by Joni Mitchell. I have it right here. I'll show you guys. Look, he came in this envelope and it says here, Distel Fink, this, and it's this, he wrapped it in glitter in an outfit of Joni's.
Wow.
Too bad it's a podcast, right? Can people see this whole thing visually, or is it just?
No.
You might have to send us a picture, and we can post it on Instagram.
Yeah. So this, I could send you a picture of this. So this, and watch this. I haven't unwrapped it in a little while, so it's special ceremony for all of us.
Da, da, da.
It's her. It's her right there, like one of her. My glasses.
Album sleeves. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the album sleeves, and it's Turbulent Indigo. That was what she did. Is homage to Jaco Pastorius, the jazz musician.
Yes.
So open it up here. And it says, to Amy from Joni.
No way.
No way.
Right here. And look at this here, too. He says this here. And this is from this is from John with a little note from him. And this is something about a Pennsylvania Dutch artist because Joni was really into that. And that is the story of these beautiful matches. There you go.
And you keep that in your office with you all the time.
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm going to wrap it back in the little disco
outfit.
Glitter.
I love the sequins. They're like aqua blue or something.
Yeah,
right?
Please send us a picture of that. I think people are desperate to see that.
Okay. Well, there's a side to Amy that we didn't know before.
I realize I'm such, I feel like I'm so boring to interview me because everyone like heard me talk forever, but I did want to give you something proprietary. And I thought the matchbook from Joni Mitchell and John Kelly was, plus I like to shout out my artist friends who are geniuses. So John Kelly,
John Kelly, we should try and meet John Kelly ourselves. Can I talk to you about that quickly, like for meeting artists? I was talking to someone at Christie's the other day and she said she'd been listening to our podcast and it gave her an insight into the artists more than she would normally have because she's kind of, you know, lower down at the Christie's and she doesn't really get to meet artists that often. Whereas for me, that seems so extraordinary because I work in a gallery, so I work with artists all the time on the primary market. Have you had a lot of connection with artists? And are there any interesting artist stories that you have from like people you've met over the years? Or is it quite separate at auction houses? Do you not...
Any nightmares? Anyone been a complete nightmare?
Look, I probably have more friends who are artists because I kind of, you know, I went to school at university here in New York and I came up to the art world and a lot of my friends were artists. So I didn't really come at this, even though I studied art history, I didn't really come at it from the sort of like, I'm going to like a professional art program and then I'm going to be a professional art person. I didn't really come at it that way. So I don't know. I guess I have a lot of friends who are artists and I have certain moments in my career where artists have played a really tremendous role. And I think artists, and I will be expansive for a minute and say visual artists, writers, musicians, like all the artists we love and know have played a super important role in my life and have been grounding and anchoring for me in trying times. And I feel like, I really think there was a part of me earlier in my career that could have become a gallerist and could have been a dealer and worked with artists. But I felt at that juncture or time in my career, I had two really small babies and I thought I needed that same exact energy it would take to run a stable of artists and work closely with them was exactly the energy I needed to raise my children. It was the same part of my heart and head.
Right.
Was that. So I needed to like that do this instead because I... you know, to like support someone and nurture them and love them and tell them they're great and do all that. Like I needed to actually do that for my children. And I needed to make sure at the end of the day, I wasn't too exhausted to do that for my children. So like it was sort of by conscious decision. I kind of went in this direction.
And I heard that your early experiences of babysitting actually then informed your later career, which I loved. The idea of like multitasking and stuff.
Oh yeah, totally. Oh God, yes. Yeah. Oh, you read that Vogue article? That was like Dodie's article, right? Was that what it was in Vogue?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was.
I had one of those scrappy childhoods where like you ran a paper route and babysat for cash, you know.
Yeah.
You had to be enterprise.
Always multitasking.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What was it like? So you said you went LA when the Christie's, when the Sotheby's announcement was making and you didn't want to be in New York where Christie's
had worked. No, I was at Christie's. I was in LA when I was leaving Christie's, not that I was starting AP. It was just sort of an announcement that I would be leaving Christie's. I didn't want to be in the fray at that moment. And that's when I met Joni Mitchell.
Right. But what was it like leaving Christie's auction house and going to Sotheby's auction house and they're like renowned rivals? Nobody knew.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't intend that, right? So when I was leaving Christie's at that dinner party meeting Joni Mitchell, I had no idea I would one day end up at Sotheby's. Like, no idea at all. I wasn't leaving. I think it's one thing to leave for the competition. It's another thing to leave and say, I'm going to go do my own thing.
Yeah. So that's you a set up your own agency. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little less attenuated and more, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't so I didn't feel that kind of drama. I mean, it was a drama for me because I was changing my own life, you know, changing my whole life and doing something entrepreneurial. And I had been at Christie's for 13 years at that time. So,
as
a pretty significant portion of my adult professional life and stuff. So,
do you have a favorite auction memory, like your first auction or one where everything went like perfectly to plan?
Life doesn't work that way. It's not like candles and champagne and hearts and unicorns and lingerie and chocolates on the pillow, baby. That's like not how life goes. So, like, if you think something is like, and in fact, if you want it to be that, you're perpetually disappointed.
Right.
You're just much better to be sort of a sociological observer of things and sort of take in what comes. And there's almost never a sale I walk out of where I'm 100% elated. I don't usually have that feeling at all, even when it goes great.
What is that then? Why is that? Just because?
It sounds like managing your expectations or something.
Well, part of it is expectations. No, it's not like I walked in, I expected everything to go through the roof and be 100%. It's not even that. It's just sort of like... maybe somebody didn't end up with something that I wish they had, or maybe, you know, an object underperformed or something absolutely irrational overperformed. And that's going to cause a problem down the road because then everybody who owns one of those is going to think it's worth 10X. And it was sort of like a,
Yeah.
It's hard to explain aberrations in the market to people who own something similar and expect that price again. Mm. I don't know. I just, there's something about it that's always a little bit of, you know, there's a big adrenaline leak at the end of an auction. Like you kind of, you know, it sucks a lot of adrenaline out of you and you're sort of, there's just that little moment of deflation, I suppose. But I don't really know what that is. I haven't really pinpointed that feeling. But it's never about that sort of, oh my God, it was magical. There was like champagne and music was playing. It was like, it's never that way for me. Like I'm not even that romantic a person. So I don't really build that kind of, I don't have those conventional fantasies in mind ever.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit about, in the primary gallery world, sometimes the auction world is really A, feared, B, kind of reviled almost. Like I often hear people over the years really be quite negative about the auction market and the effect of like auctions on the primary market and all of these
factors.
On younger
artists and things.
Yeah, and younger artists and all that stuff. But I've heard you very eloquently sum all of this up, and I would love you to just speak a bit about that as well and the kind of importance of the art market too.
Sure. Well, I mean, I do think people feel like that the, you know, when people are afraid of auctions, they're really afraid of the market, right? It's what the market is going to say, because the market is going to have their moment of judgment on something. Mm-hmm. And I always say, well, being afraid of the market is like being afraid of the weather. Like it's not really something you can control precisely. And the smartest thing to do is to prepare yourself to deal with it and dress accordingly, let's say, or I think there's just generally an anxiety or fear of the unknown, like what will happen. You know, auction has that uncertainty of not really knowing the outcome. Mm. But I think it's important to sort of run toward that energy rather than away from it. Like it's never going away. It's a bit like you can't put an ostrich, put your head in the sand and say, I hate it. I'm never going to deal with it. Like it's just simply not the case. Right. But also,
like, buy an umbrella is what you said once, which I love.
Yeah, bring an umbrella. Like, right, there you go.
If it's going to rain, get an umbrella.
Yeah, get an umbrella. And I also feel like, look, we are the auctions are the mechanism that brings liquidity to the market.
Right.
And so while everybody, no way all these primary market artists can have a great career without an auction market attached. So, you know, it's like saying, I want to have everything be optimal every day all the time. It's like, well, okay, well, that's not really, you know, possible or likely, but there, you can't bring liquidity or raise prices on the primary market until you really have tested and parsed out the market to know where the breakpoints are. So every time a dealer raises an artist's prices, there's usually an auction house to thank.
Right. Yeah, there's a parallel correlation.
Do you have internal conversations about, like, when, you know, the flipping, the dangers of flipping or the responsibility for younger artists and seeing that happen? Is there like internal discussions about how to navigate them situations?
Look, it's just the market. Like it doesn't really, if there's a market for it, if I could sell this, you see this pen, it's not very dear to me. And if I could sell it for about what I paid for it, maybe I would if I wanted the money. Right. But like, it's just a different kind of decision. And so an artist who's making this or making things, you have to just be mindful. Okay, I would tell every living artist to hold back great examples of their own work and not sell everything.
Mm, that's good advice.
Feel rich in your own stock, and if you can afford to, which you've got to be able to afford to. And you know, don't expect people will sell. Right. Even if they say they're going to give it to museums, they sometimes sell. So like, there's no promises in life. Just make sure you're fortified and cared for. You have your own examples and you've sort of managed your success accordingly, or your hopeful future success accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And actually the idea of sort of protecting yourself and also your expectations. So if you do sell something, you know, it's an object that has a market value of some kind. So you just need to accept that, I guess, which I think some people just don't understand.
Right.
And it's just hypocrisy, really. But also I loved this kind of sentiment that you had, which I referenced in the introduction, which is about being a sovereign state.
Oh,
can you just give that bit of advice? Because I think it's so profound and actually really important.
You have to be a sovereign nation. Like you have to be, your borders can only be protected or defended by you.
Yes.
And you can't expect someone to take care of you in lieu of you taking care of yourself. Like someone can take care of you and you're taking care of yourself, but not in lieu of. And so that's really important. I tell a lot of, you know, I say that to artists. I mean, I say that to women. I say that to nearly anybody who will listen. Like, that's really very, very important. And if you're busy feeling like somehow you were shortchanged, it's because you probably weren't, you let your borders be too porous. And I don't mean that emotionally. Like, I don't mean we should be like emotionally guarded and blocked at all times, but we should manage ourselves and our hopes and dreams and aspirations and expectations wisely and intelligently against, you know, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat these two imposters just the same, right? So if you can sort of manage it all, that's really key. But being sovereign is what keeps you feeling good on your worst days.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
How often do you check in with your clients and collectors?
I mean, pretty often, I guess, you know. Yes, often.
And you can spot when something comes up, you're like, I know exactly who will want that.
Yeah, sometimes I try to pick something that's of very high quality and special, but maybe slightly in left field.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's good to expand what you think is right. It's good to pivot and change and grow.
And what are you proudest of?
I don't know if I really allow myself to examine those kind of moments. Very good question. I think, there's someone I worked with a long time ago who I really kind of pushed them to buy something that was beyond their comprehension at that time. And now, 10 years later, it's the centerpiece of their house.
Oh, wow.
And I really love that. Like, I knew this would be right for them, and it had worked. It happened. It turned out to be the right object for them spiritually.
Wow. And did I say to you all the time, thanks, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit, yeah. I don't need to hear that, but...
For those who can't see, though, your actual face just lit up then with this kind of like radiant joy. And you obviously do get an immense satisfaction from your work.
Yeah, right. I do.
You love your job.
I do.
That's amazing. So you must work with clients with all different budgets, but what would you advise for a young collector who wants to get into being a collector and they might not have a massive amount of money, but they have a select amount of money that they want to invest wisely? What advice would you give them?
Really, really look a lot before you leap, like buy. Hold on. Is it now? Is it here? Okay. I would say look, you know, do a lot of homework, like really study and learn. And really, really, what you're learning is not so much about the art, but what you like who you are.
So we have two quick questions that we ask every guest before we finish the episode. So one is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork from around the world and you could have it safely and we would help you, what artwork would you take home?
Gosh, like just one?
Yes, just mm-hmm. one. And we can bring trucks or cranes or helicopters or anything that's needed or a bag.
Wow, just one? That's so hard. I mean, gosh, I really am like mystified and stumped. I mean, I guess I've always loved, like, I would love a great, wonderful, amazing A+ Basquiat.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like some I've sold over the years. And,
would you be involved in that sale of the most expensive Basquiat ever sold?
Yeah.
That was your sale?
Yeah. That was our sale here at Sotheby's in 17. I guess a great, you know, I can think of a couple of different Basquiats I would love to nab and steal. I would love to have Felix Gonzalez Torres's Perfect Lovers, the double clock.
Yes.
Oh,
I
think that's a masterpiece.
We love that piece.
Absolutely.
Masterpiece.
We spoke about it yesterday with Glenn Ligon.
And with Ronnie Horn, masterpiece. We spoke about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece, really. Love it. And that's really, really dear. I collect Glenn Ligon, actually. I have a lot of his things.
Oh, you do?
For years and years.
I think he's one of the most important artists ever, really. He's just extraordinary.
He is genius and brilliant. I feel the same way. I get to live with him every day. I love him.
Lucky
personally
you.
And professionally, but I love his work. His work is what lives in me, really.
Yes.
What else would I do the heist for, the big heist? Gosh, I can think of so many great paintings. I can't even, I mean, it's to be honest with you, I could just start like rattling and just be crazy.
Yeah, rattle. Give us your
rattle
top five.
Quickly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean.
Let the art out, Amy.
let it go, let it open up, let it go. Oh, you know, there's the Harwood Museum in New Mexico has a whole suite of Agnes Martins that she donated to be site specific there. I love that. Okay, that's very, 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 very special, I think. You know, there's a Gorky painting called Scent of Apricots that I love that's magnificent. I guess at MoMA, there's so many things. I mean, Star Starry Night would be like, it's sort of like an obvious thing, but it is something early in my life that sparked me. And I really loved that very obvious painting made into refrigerator magnets and t-shirts. I loved it.
There's a reason for that, though, because they are extraordinary artworks, aren't they?
Because of its greatness, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, my God. I guess there's... Art Institute of Chicago has such great things.
Right.
Great, superb museum there as well.
Is that one of your favorite museums as well?
I do love to go. I do, you know, I do have a nice relationship to Chicago, and I never thought I could live there or anything, but I just love how committed to the town Chicagoans are, and I love how committed to their institutions they are, and how wonderful the museums are in Chicago. Like it's a city that punches so above its weight in its cultural riches. Gosh, I mean, to be honest with you, it's endless. Like I just start naming things. You know.
Well, we love it. I mean, we can definitely help you with all of those. Yeah. We're going to do a massive art heist.
And your kids are into art. You were saying earlier that you took your son to the David Hammond show. Are they going into the same world as you? Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I got to go because I have another meeting. But I hope so. I mean, I hope a little bit, but I don't hope too much. They have to find it on their own. I'm not pushing them.
Got it.
And the final question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
A color I can't live without might be red, might be orange.
Good one.
Rob loves orange.
You're wearing red right now.
I'm wearing red, but orange is like, I really love orange. Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
You're the best, Amy.
It's been such a joy.
You guys.
Absolute joy talking to you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.